Hello, I'm Nick Clark. This is Counting the Costs on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, it was an unexpected move. A decision by OPEC Plus to cut oil output has sent prices higher. So why did the Saudi-led group cut production? And how does that affect the fight against inflation? Also this week, the UK agrees to join the Asia-Pacific trade bloc, and the Prime Minister says the deal demonstrates the real economic benefits of Britain's post-Brexit freedoms. But does it? Plus, Africa alone needs more than $3 trillion by 2030 to avoid the worst effects of climate change, but the continent has received only a small fraction of the required financing. So the Saudi-led oil-producing group had signalled it would hold oil supply steady to maintain a stable market. But in a surprise move, the OPEC Plus alliance, which includes Russia, slashed output by more than 1 million barrels a day, its second cut in more than 6 months. It's feared this could send oil prices back to $100 a barrel and may raise tensions between Riyadh and the United States, which has called on the kingdom to pump more oil in a bid to tame inflation. Umeh Kulsoom Sharif has this report.
U.S. President Joe Biden downplayed the impact when major oil-producing countries announced production cuts. But it's rattled markets and sent oil prices soaring. Oil Alliance, OPEC and its allies, including Russia, known as the OPEC Plus, account for about 40% of global crude output.
That's a pretty big deal. I mean, OPEC Plus had been signaling previously, you know, it's kind of the steady as she goes output strategy. But if you take a look at their market behavior in recent years and months, I mean, not so surprising, right? So, you know, oil had been showing weakness. It had been under $80 a barrel persistently, which is, you know, seems to be an informal floor now for the Saudis. At least when you see oil at or under that level, you have to figure that the Saudis are at least thinking about taking action.
Prices have been volatile in the past year. On April the 3rd, Brent crude traded close to $85 a barrel. Just weeks before, it dipped to a 15-month low of $70 a barrel. And in early March 2022, after Russia invaded Ukraine, crude rocketed to more than $130 a barrel. Analysts warn the cuts will push up prices and make it more difficult to reduce the cost of living.
Anybody that's producing oil is going to benefit from this. So, oil producing countries, lots of spending going on in those countries, lots more investment upstream in producing more oil, as well as social programs, construction plans, lots of infrastructure spending in those countries. I would suspect that's going to continue. And it's also going to push, inflation in the rest of the world.
The move comes as global economic growth slows. It's also likely to further raise tension between Saudi Arabia and the U.S., which had asked producers to increase output to bring down prices. Umeh Kulsoom Sharif, Al Jazeera, for Counting the Cost.
Well, joining us now from Edinburgh is Torbjørn Soltvedt. He's a principal and MENA analyst at the risk intelligence company, Verisk Maplecroft. Torbjørn, welcome to the programme. It's not so much steady as she goes. Why this move now, do you think?
Well, that's the million-dollar question right now. I think it's fair to say that the announcement pretty much caught everyone off guard to some extent. And probably as a result of that, we've seen a fairly broad range of different explanations for the cut. Some of them leaning more towards this being a political decision, and then others, leaning more towards this being market-based. And I think when you look at it now, a couple of days in, there's definitely several layers to this cut. Of course, the official line is that it was a precautionary measure aimed at stabilizing the market. Now, of course, OPEC doesn't officially talk about prices, but at the same time, it's not really controversial to say that the prices that we saw earlier this month, kind of moving down towards $70 per barrel, was a lot lower than what OPEC would like. And then you have another really interesting angle at the moment, which is what the Saudi energy minister, Abdulaziz bin Salman, sometimes referred to as ABS, has been talking about now for some time. And that is that OPEC wants to keep oil market speculators on their toes. So part of this cut was probably also intended to kind of send a shot across the bow to short sellers. So really the short answer here is that it was probably a combination of trying to support prices, some concerns over demand in the global economy, and then also making sure that speculators, as ABS put it quite funnily, would be ouching like hell.
And then there's the argument that some are saying that Saudi and its allies are setting a floor of $80 a barrel below which it will never go now.
Yeah, so I mean, I think when you look at most of the oil price forecasts for this year, they have been kind of ranging between $80 and $100. And the thinking there is that, as you say, OPEC is trying to defend $80 per barrel. And then on the other sort of end, I guess you have the United States and China trying to put a ceiling in at around $100 per barrel. Last year, we saw the United States use its SPR, Strategic Petroleum Reserve, quite extensively. That probably prevented a major surge in prices beyond what we saw. And then, again, China as well has a very extensive SPR that it can use to kind of try and put a ceiling in to sort of counter the OPEC floor, if you like.
Right. And for Russia, for them, it's good news, the higher the prices, right?
Yeah, I think as for all oil producing countries, higher prices is good up to a certain point. Russia and OPEC have to be careful, of course, that they don't push prices so high that it starts to impact demand. We're obviously at a kind of a tense time for the global economy. Now, for Russia, there is obviously the element of the G7 price cap, but when you look at sort of the nitty-gritty of the global oil trade and then the way that oil trade works, it's really difficult to make that watertight and to make sure that it works properly. So it's very hard to say exactly how well the price cap has worked so far. So the bottom line is still that higher prices of oil is good for Russia. And oil prices has always been a sensitive topic when it comes to geopolitics, but it's clearly even more sensitive now that you have the war in Ukraine and the fact that increased revenue for Russia is good for Russia and the Russian war effort. So that partly explained why oil prices have become such a sensitive topic, even more so than in the last few years.
Sure. What about the U.S. side of things? The U.S. President Joe Biden says it's not as bad as we think, but prices have shot up by, 8%, which is pretty hectic.
Yeah, I think the U.S. Reaction this time is really interesting. I think you can contrast it with last autumn, the last big OPEC cut, which took place last October, and the U.S. came out very, very strongly then and threatened consequences and really trying to push back against that cut. And what actually happened was that it ended up being counterproductive in the sense that the U.S. reaction just drew more attention to the cut and probably amplified the impact of the cut. So it looks like they've learned their lesson from that time. So it's been more muted this time. The White House has said that they don't think this cut is advisable right now, but they're still coordinating with OPEC. They apparently were given a heads up beforehand. Broadly speaking, relations between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. Are going through a difficult moment, but both sides are trying to manage this, and it looks like it's been a lot better managed than last October when things were really kind of reaching a boiling point.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because the US is the world's largest consumer of oil, but also the world's largest producer. Can't it just start producing more?
Well, I mean, I think that this is where it gets really complicated with different types of crude grades going to different refineries. The oil that comes from the U.S. shale sector, which has accounted for the big surge in U.S. oil production, is of a particular grade, generally speaking. So there is still very much a global oil market, and what happens in the rest of the world definitely impacts prices at the pump in the United States. Again, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is something that the U.S. has used effectively in the past, but when it comes to refilling that, some of those volumes has to come from oil that isn't from the United States. So it's not a local oil market, it's very much a global oil market. So that is why it's difficult for the United States to kind of push back against these cuts, especially because they made massive releases last year, the biggest release ever. So they need to keep some of their powder dry. They don't want to drain the reserve too much. So it's looking a bit more difficult for them to counter OPEC this year. But we have to remember China's role here as well, and China can also use its strategic petroleum reserve to try and put a ceiling on prices. At the moment, you know, oil is sitting at around sort of $85 per barrel, so we're not anywhere near 100 yet. So I think just for now, you know, all of the main actors are kind of just watching to see what is going to happen next, but trying not to panic and trying to stay calm.
And how will this affect the global economy and the fight against inflation?
Yeah, so as you said, we've already seen, you know, a bit of a spike in oil prices in the futures market and in the short term. You know, it's probably not something that is going to push oil prices outside of the range that most forecasts expected for this year. But at the same time, if we do end up with Brent crude, say, you know, $5 or $10 above where it would have been without this cut, then that's obviously something that ultimately will be, you know, passed on to consumers, especially with transport costs. The good news, I suppose, is that, you know, the extreme gas prices that we saw last year, especially in Europe, has started to come down somewhat. Now, with this sort of increase in oil prices, that's going to eat into that somewhat. So, you know, even though prices hasn't sort of surged massively yet, you know, the cut is still bad news for governments that are trying to bring inflation under control, especially at a time when they're really concerned about growing socioeconomic pressure and the potential for civil unrest as well.
Torbjørn Soltvedt, great to get your analysis. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, many British businesses complain that Britain's departure from the European Union has increased their costs and hurt exports and imports. And the Office for Budget Responsibility expects the exit from the EU to reduce the UK's output by 4% over 15 years. But Brexit supporters say the nation could capitalise on joining trade blocs with faster-growing economies than those closer to home. The UK just joined a trade pact with 11 Asia and Pacific nations, its biggest trade deal since Brexit. Well, the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP, was established in 2018. It includes Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam. Membership of the CPTPP loosens restrictions on trade between members and reduces tariffs on goods. More than 99% of UK exports to the 11 other countries will now be eligible for tariff-free trade. The deal also aims to cut red tape for British businesses. Firms are no longer required to set up offices or be residents of the PAC's member countries to provide services there. The trade area covers a market of around 500 million people and will be worth 15% of the world's income once the United Kingdom formally joins. Well, the UK has signed trade deals and agreements with more than 70 countries and one with the EU since its departure from the bloc in 2020. The terms of the majority of those agreements were rolled over from its previous membership of the EU. The Australia deal was the first trade agreement negotiated by the UK since Brexit. The US is a significant trading partner, accounting for at least 16% of total UK trade. But a free trade deal between the two nations has stalled. Well, joining us now from London is Vicky Price, who is the Chief Economic Advisor at the Centre for Economics and Business Research. Vicky, welcome. By its own reckoning, the UK government estimates this will increase economic output by less than 0.1%. So really, just how significant is this?
I think the significance is mainly in highlighting the fact that the UK wants to be a global player rather than necessarily the impact it may have on GDP, and hopes that that will lead to maybe more trade deals with more countries, possibly even joining this partnership. I mean, there is suggestion that South Korea and maybe China might do so as well. That, of course, you know, expands the reach, if you like. But the UK has been trying to find new areas to trade with. The reality is that of those 11 countries right now in this partnership, nine countries already have agreements with the UK. Some of them had been rolled over after we left the EU, so they were the result of Brexit. So we tried to do more or less what was there in terms of agreements within the EU and those countries. But there are only two countries that we haven't made any agreements with so far on the trade front, and those are Malaysia and Brunei. So that's probably why the gains in GDP are so small. But there have been, you know, deals that we have signed more recently, in addition to the 69 or so that we've rolled over. So there is a lot of activity going on to just get, you know, the world to believe that this is global Britain. But of course, the loss of the EU trade or some of the EU trade is much more significant in terms of its impact on GDP.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that, about how much trade is being lost and how much further the UK has to go to try and replace it.
There is a lot of disagreement as to what's actually happened so far, because, you know, depending on the analysis that you do, there is confusion in relation to the impact of COVID. There's also, of course, you know, the impact of the war in Ukraine, and all that has messed the figures up a little bit, if you like. But there is no doubt, I think, in anything you look at, if you ask companies, and if you look at the trade with Europe, and if you look what's happened since the COVID restrictions were lifted, the UK has been facing more costs in terms of trade with the EU, has been reducing its trade with Europe more generally, and hasn't been able to pick up in terms of the percentage of trade it does, like other countries have done since the reduction in loads of COVID restrictions. So that suggests that Brexit has had an impact, and the loss of trade with the EU, which has remained, of course, our main trading partner, is going to have more permanent impact on the UK economy, which loads and loads of exporters are already complaining about. And also, of course, on the import side, we're just about to finally introduce more restrictions at the border. So that's going to complicate matters even more.
As far as this deal is concerned, who gains, who loses?
Small firms particularly lose. I think this is one of the problems. You can sell very easily to a region near you. You can't really sell that easily to places that are far away. The costs are quite significant. So bigger firms would be able to perhaps benefit more from any deal that we do with countries in the Asia Pacific region. But the truth is, of course, that if you look at the deals that have been done so far, such as, for example, the new ones with Australia and New Zealand, and also what may be the case with some of those countries that we may be joining in this new agreement that we're going to have, the Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership that we might join, there is concern that agriculture in particular is going to be an area that will be hit in the UK, because it looks like some of those deals that we've done so far give more benefit to the countries that we've done the deals with in terms of accessing our market in food products than we getting in return. So that needs to be sorted out, because we do know that our farmers have been worried and complaining about this. So one would imagine that that will be taken notice of in whatever happens next.
And environmentally, what about the UK's climate commitments? They're saying that this will encourage deforestation. Why is that?
Well, I mean, the worry is that if we are likely to be importing more products from places where, you know, some of those environmental issues are not that you know, seriously taken, then that's going to have an impact. But it's interesting what may be happening in the UK, because what we have been seeing is a shift away from producing our own products to really being much more concerned about the environment, and therefore encouraging farmers not to plant, encouraging reforestation, if you like, or rewilding in the UK countryside. With the war in Ukraine in particular, and with serious concerns about food security, what we might be seeing in the short term is a reversal of that and a lot more emphasis on producing our own goods. So it will be interesting to see how those trade deals fit in with that new environment. And I think this chopping and changing, perhaps, policies is not going to be good for long-term sustainability, if you like, and resilience of our farming sector in the UK.
Vicky Price, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, from devastating cyclones and floods to unrelenting drought, African countries are suffering the worst consequences of climate change, despite contributing less than 4% of global carbon emissions. And they're estimated to pay up to 9% of their budgets to respond to the extreme weather events. Yet a new report by the Climate Policy Initiative says the continent only received a tenth of the annual climate finance it needs in 2020. That's nearly $30 billion out of more than $277 billion required annually to meet its climate goals by 2030. Well, US Vice President Kamala Harris announced more than $7 billion in private sector funding to help Africa combat and adapt to climate change. The announcement came after her week-long trip to Ghana, Tanzania and Zambia last month. Rich nations have failed to keep a $100 billion a year pledge to developing nations to help them make the shift to renewable energy and bolster their infrastructure against extreme weather. Well, joining us now from Boston is Salim Fakir, who is Executive Director of the African Climate Foundation and board member of the Atlantic Special Economic Zone. Salim Fakir, thanks for joining us here on Counting the Cost. First up, $7 billion barely touches the sides of what's required.
It's clear that we need a lot more funding to deal with the climate crisis. And I think they're at two levels. One is definitely dealing with the consequences of extreme weather or climate vulnerability and risk. And the other is also trying to solve the world's challenges around bringing down emission levels. On the continent itself, as you know, the statistics are not really good. There's currently climate damages are in a much more larger sums than what is proposed as possible solutions to dealing with the crisis. So we would need to mobilize far more funds from the global financial system.
Why is private sector funding in Africa lower than anywhere else in the world?
It's concentrated in four or five countries, particularly in South Africa, which has a very mature market, developed market. The risk profile of some of these countries is deemed to be lower. But in general, the rest of the continent is deemed to be a high-risk continent. But, you know, the irony of it is that African countries that borrow tend to honor their debt much better than many other countries, but yet they are paying at the cost of debt at much higher cost. And so there's a risk perception that needs to be dealt with. And there could be multiple reasons for that. It's one of the barriers that is seen to increase private investment. There are two levels. One is around the supply of credible and sort of what in the private sector language is called de-risk. And the other is also being able to match that with the ability to attract and mobilize funds into the continent.
The issue of debt could be dealt with, of course, with this concept of the debt for climate swap, where debt is reduced for green investment. Is that something that's got traction, do you think?
So what you find is that given the post-COVID phase, that there's been a lot of debt distress, particularly for countries like Cape Verde, as you might have noted, the Portuguese government has taken original debt and converted that into a debt for nature type of swap and said to the Cape Verde government, we would forego a certain amount of debt service costs per year for you to commit to dealing with climate issues and many other ecological issues. And so that's an interesting model. Although not every country can do debt for nature swaps, and it depends on how it is structured, how costly it is to put it together, and whether there's also ability to monitor and ensure that some form of debt forgiveness, there's a ability of the state to implement and honor the debt for nature swap agreement.
It is
an interesting model.
An interesting model indeed. But the bottom line is that developed nations have failed woefully on this issue of financing developing nations. Is that down to individual leaderships of the nations, or is it down to the big multilateral institutions like the IMF and the World Bank?
I think, as you will know, there are different processes at the moment to evaluate reforms into international multilateral development system. There's a need to reform the finance architecture. these discussions are happening in the World Bank, the IMF, and many other places. There's also the Macron process that is going to happen in June. There's a recognition that we have to do a lot more to integrate the need for finance for climate purposes. And one of the reform pillars would be to ensure that multilateral development institutions can increase their ability to provide these kinds of funds.
Salim Fakir, we appreciate that. Thanks very much. And there we have our show for this week. If you'd like to comment on anything you've seen, you can just tweet me, at Nick Clark Al Jazz. Please use the hashtag AJCTC or just drop us an email. countingthecosts@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's plenty more for you online at aljazeera.com/ttc, and that will take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and indeed entire episodes for you to catch up on. But that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Nick Clark from the whole team. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.